will come in and explain more after we don't have Reverend Precious time. So with that, again.
Thank you. Thank you. This is a treat. And I'm a little... Let me start with just a moment of quiet and breathing. And this is going to be 99.9% me teaching, but I just want to breathe with you guys for a minute. That would help me. Thank you. Thank you. So recently I've been cultivating a set of teachings. One teaching on living with less fear, and the other on living with less judgment. And as I've been working on those two talks, the election happened. And part of what drove my desire to teach about judgment and fear is the lack of civility, the level of incivility that is becoming normalized in our culture, and a lot of incivility that is being speaking out of living in fear, and this horrible judgmentalism toward one another. So that's been the catalyst of a lot of my teaching. I did a TED talk at Burning Man on living with less judgment. And when we get to the judgment talk, I'll talk a little bit about that. But the election has shifted my thinking in some ways. Because there is so much of the spirituality movement has to do with us purifying our own hearts. And what the election has sort of opened my eyes to is that I'm living in this world filled with people in pain and fear and anxiety. And that for me, justice can no longer be a hobby. It needs to be a vocation. And so part of what I'm doing is looking also at the teachings that I was working on in the context of how our souls are saved when we get down in the trenches with people who are hurting, and we, you know, we strive for justice and peace in the world. So I want to bring those kinds of concepts into what I'm going to be doing for the next three evenings. And I want to... So I want to start with a little bit of historical context, because I think, because I want to move this talk out of the abstract, let's live with less fear and less judgment, to holy shit, the world's falling apart, I want to provide a little bit of historical context so that these teachings can be placed in this moment. And I think we're in an important moment. And let me... How many of you know Yeats's poem, The Second Coming? So let me just read the first half. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed. And everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. So the end of the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s was a time of profound optimism. We were solving every problem and ruling the world. At that time, we had cars. We were learning to fly airplanes. We had discovered penicillin, right? We cured disease. We were so connected through the telephone ways. And there was this time of profound optimism because our great big science-y brains were solving all the problems and making everything possible. And we were on the brink of this new grand possibility. And then Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, and alliances came into play. World War I started, and it was the machine gun. See, all of the sciencey stuff we were developing was then turned into weapons, and the machine gun was really the thing that made World War I what it was, because now one person with a single pull of a trigger could shoot, you know, 1,000 rounds downrange in a minute, and the battlefield stopped. No one could move in the battlefield, so they dug into trenches, and then we had to invent mustard gas, which was heavier than air, that would then flow through trenches like rivers. And then we used these new planes we were inventing and learning how to drop bombs on people. And almost 20 million people were killed and wounded in World War I. And then right after World War I, a flu pandemic killed 50 million people. 50 million people. The world was devastated. Particularly Europe was absolutely devastated. And the countries that were devastated by the war had the added hit of this flu pandemic. And if you imagine, So they had this added hit of the flu pandemic, and they went from this time of just optimism and all possibility to, oh my God, look at how horrible we are to one another, and we can't save ourselves. And it was in that time, in Europe in particular, when nationalism came to the fore, and it made room for Mussolini and Hitler and Lenin to rise up, right? So that was a particular time in history where, and the parallels that I'm experiencing are, we're at this point in one sense of profound optimism. I mean, with the internet and like these things, we're in a whole, like in the last 20 years, an entire new world has been born in front of us. And we think everything is possible with this and AI and robots and the stuff that's just around the corner. Right, we have all of this amazing possibility, and at the same time, right now we're seeing in our country this rise of hatred and animus toward people who are different, and this rise of nationalism and wanting to circle the wagons and sort of go like this as a country and as a people. I think we're at an important historic time. The other historic time I'm thinking about is the civil rights movement. And right now, people are becoming aware of racial bias that has been existing but not seen by many people. And now it's just becoming really apparent. So I think we're reliving Europe in the 30s, and we're reliving in some ways the U.S. in the 60s in terms of the tensions and the fears that are being expressed. And the question is, how are we going to do it differently? And what's going to be the state of our souls? So this is our moment. We were born for this time right now. And the question is, who are you going to be in this time right now? And that's the context that I want to sort of lay out as the air I'm presenting these teachings in. Any feedback or thoughts, or you think I'm off base, or this is resonating, or
Strong resonation.
Okay.
Yeah. Feeling like we're at the top of the apex of a shift into a new way of being for
right.
a while. Some blessings come in incredibly curious packages.
Thank you.
But I think there's enough for everyone.
Right. But that's, yes, we'll, and we'll get to that. Okay. So, I was meeting with my clergy staff today, and we were talking about the core beliefs and the core values that we use as a touchstone. Like in a time, right, where the center is no longer holding and the ceremony of innocence is drowned, what are the core values, the core beliefs that you're standing on to guide your heart so you don't lose your soul when everything around you is going crazy? So you get to figure that out for yourself, but I'll tell you what we came up with. I'll tell you what in my religious context our core values are. And the first is that every human being on the face of the planet is a beloved child of God, deserving of and capable of love. Every human being is a beloved child of God, including the people you don't like, the people that drive you crazy, and they are deserving of love, and they're also capable of love. Desmond Tutu, in his book on forgiveness, says, don't ever call anyone a monster because you let them off the hook, right? If you call them a monster, then they, you know, then they're no longer accountable. They're just a monster, right? But everyone is capable of love. We need to say we expect better of you. Right? So everyone is a beloved child of God, deserving of and capable of love. The second is that our primary task is to love the world into wholeness. So our primary task is to love the world into wholeness. And we do that, there are several ways we do that. One is we start with the broken and the brokenhearted. So we pay attention to the broken and the brokenhearted in our world. We also welcome the outcast. We welcome the stranger. We welcome the alien. We do not build walls. Right? We don't build walls. We welcome the stranger. So pay attention to the outcast, listen for the cry of the poor, and welcome the stranger. We stand against cruelty and injustice. And one of the ways we do that is we set clear boundaries. It is not okay. It is not okay to paint a swastika on a church and say whites only. Right? It's not okay. And we set clear boundaries, and we set clear boundaries in love. Right? We keep our hearts pure. It's not, you don't end that with, you asshole. Right? You just say, it is not okay. And we create opportunities for connection and reconciliation, which is one thing our world desperately needs, is opportunities for connection and reconciliation. We are moving so much more into our like-minded silos that we need to, if we're going to love the world into wholeness, we need to create opportunities for people who voted for different presidential candidates to come together and get and like have moments of understanding and reconciliation. And then we do all of that with integrity. Meaning we don't let the cruelty of other people rob us of our ability to love. So we live in a world where there's cruelty around us and the mean people are around us, but we don't let that cruelty rob us of our ability to love. We keep our hearts pure and loving in the midst of that. We don't become what we hate. We don't become what we're fighting against. Those are sort of like the foundational guiding beliefs that are the foundation for what I want to talk about. This came up with today. So this is all new. This is new teaching. And I really want feedback at some point. Like you can email me or something saying this has really resonated because I'm trying to figure out what works and what doesn't in what I'm trying to present. Now I want to get to material that I've been working on in terms of spiritual practices for this conflicted, harsh time. And for me, the goal in the spiritual life, in this conflicted, harsh time, in any time, the goal of the spiritual life is Holy Communion, is to be in Holy Communion with God and to be in Holy Communion with all other humans. Let me say something about God. I'm one of the things that was funny about the form that I filled out. So I was asked to teach, and then I had to fill out a form about what my class was about. There's this thing at the top saying, Diamond Light wants authentic Tibetan Buddhist teaching. This is not authentic Tibetan Buddhist teaching. I'm a guest coming in from a different tradition, so I'm going to be presenting you stuff from my context, and I'm expecting you to translate it and however you need to translate it so that it is helpful in your context.
Thank you. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad I'm here, because I'm a guest, and I'm here at listening to an Episcopal priest. I thought I was doing Buddhism.
Well, you're not for tonight.
I was raised Catholic, so I'm a little more open toward Episcopal.
So for me, the goal of the spiritual life, the goal of life, is to be in holy communion with God and with other humans, with other people. And that love is the only command. Like, the only path to be in holy communion is love. To live in love, to live in love with other humans. Like, that's our only tool. That's the only, like, only weapon we have is love. And the other thing about this goal is also is a shift in consciousness from binary thinking or dualistic thinking to unitive consciousness. Cynthia Bergeau, who's an Episcopalian Christian meditation teacher, she talks about an operating system change in human consciousness, and that we're going from humanity 1.0 to humanity 2.0, where rather than living in the world where we're constantly separating and dividing, you know, looking at how we're different and separate, we begin to live in a world where we realize how connected we are. Like, as long as we think we're separate, we will suffer, right? So to realize how connected we are. So those are some of the, for me, what it means to be in Holy Communion, is to realize that love is the only thing I can do. Like, love God, love your neighbor as yourself, love everyone. Jesus said, love your enemy, which means have no enemies. And that we are connected in ways that we don't understand. The problem, what gets in the way, and I have very thick rose-colored glasses, so I can see the goal, but what gets in the way is a multitude of things. One is wrong thinking, right? We think we're separate. We live in this ego-driven world where what's most important is me and mine. So part of it is a shift in thinking. So I'm gonna list some things that get in the way. Another is scapegoating. Scapegoating is a primal mechanism in communities where we have cohesion by finding a scapegoat and blaming all of our problems on a scapegoat. And when we blame problems on us, it's really effective. We blame problems on a scapegoat, and then we feel better about our cohesion. And this is sort of a primal mechanism that exists in humans. So that's another problem, and you see it all around us, right? The scapegoating, and of which then diverts attention away from the real conversations we need to have as a community if we're blaming our problems on someone else. Scarcity, thinking there's not enough. And we live in scarcity so much. I mean, it's this fear of not having enough, not being enough. And I was reading Lynn Twist's book on The Soul of Money. And she was talking about scarcity. And she pointed out something. We wake up in the morning, and our first thought is usually out of scarcity,
right,
which is, I didn't get enough sleep.
Right.
If only I got more sleep, then my day would be better. Right? We start that. We start our days thinking, if only I had much. Or there was a poll taken asking people how much more money they needed to be happy, and everyone said a third more than they were getting, you know, regardless of where their economic position was. If only I had, right, this scarcity thinking rather than realizing that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So scarcity is another thing that gets in the way of us, because when you're living in scarcity, you're doing this, right, rather than doing this. And then fear. Everyone is paralyzed by fear. Every human on the face of the planet is paralyzed by fear. We're going to talk about that. Maybe tonight we'll get into that. Judging other people, being all judgy, denying the goodness of yourself and others gets in the way. That inner critic that is constantly like cutting yourself, saying things to you that you would never say to someone else, right? And then another one that I wrote today was indifference. And that's a big one. Isolation. You know, I'm okay. And not caring about how other people are doing is a big thing that gets in the way of us living in Holy Communion. So those are some of the obstacles that get in the way. And then what I want to do with our time in the next few nights is talk about antidotes to some of those obstacles. And the three things I think I want to do are talk about fear, talk about letting go of fear, talk about letting go of judgment, and then I also want to talk about rolling up our sleeves and getting involved in the brokenness of other people and how we're being called to make justice and the caring of other people our vocation at this time and to speak up. So those are some of the primary things that I think I want to talk about. Let me say one thing. Let me talk about, before we go to fear. Oh, we're doing okay on time so far. I want to talk about spirit. I want to talk about oneness. I want to talk about unit of consciousness, and I want to talk about the paradox of the notion that we are all one, like we are all connected. John Donne's No Man Is an Island, don't ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Any man's death diminishes me, don't ask for whom the bell tolls. Any man's death diminishes mankind, don't ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. So that there's a way in which we are all one as human beings, a way that, like, we should give a damn about other people just because they're humans. There's a way in which we are connected to other humans, but also there's like a deeper oneness that exists that I think is the center of what John Donne was writing about in the poem, in that part of the poem, on, you know, For Whom the Bell Tolls. But it's also in what Dr. Martin Luther King was saying about whatever affects one person indirectly or directly affects all of us indirectly, because we are all knit together in this network of mutuality. Like, we're all part of this human community, and someone's suffering matters to me in sort of an existential, ontological way. It matters to me. I'm connected to that. And I also think that what unites us, this, after going to Burning Man a couple of times and experiencing the temple in Burning Man, and the temple in Burning Man is this profound piece of the experience. And the temple at Burning Man is this beautiful structure that gets burned at the end of our time together. And everyone goes to the temple. The temple is the most populous place at any given moment in time during the 9-day festival. And people write prayers and laments and longings all throughout the temple. And they'll be beautiful, you know, I miss you, Mom, kinds of things. One was a woman with a picture of her father, the date of birth, date of death, something like, you know, I miss you, Dad, and then in parentheses at the bottom, you would be proud of me. And people bring ashes, there were wedding dresses, and a lot of forgive. Forgive me, I'm sorry, I forgive my rapists. There was one black chalkboard with white writing on it, the top in bold letters, F you my rapists, F you the police who didn't believe me. And it was this long screed with no resolution. It was just this anguish being poured out. And people go through, everyone goes through the temple. And not everyone writes, but everyone goes to the temple. Everyone reads what's there. And then when the temple is burned on the last night, on Sunday night, it is, the man is burned the night before, and it's this raucous party. When the temple is burned, it's complete silence. 40,000 people, I would estimate, were sitting around the temple. 40,000 people in complete silence for an hour, holding on to each other, weeping as the temple was being burned. I don't think we're connected by a shared ideology. I think we're connected by a shared longing. There's a longing in the human heart and the human soul that we all have. And it's right, you can feel it, that longing to love and be loved and be connected. And that, I think, is this piece of this oneness of all humanity that is the place of connection with all humanity. We all know what it's like to be brokenhearted and broken, right? That's our place of connection with all of humanity. And that's when we're at our most real, when we're stripped bare. It's at that place that is our connection. So there is a way in which we are all one. And I think it's important to realize that there is a way in which we are not all one. And this is something that we've come into as a people in the last 30 years or so. Because it used to be we want to be a melting pot. And what I'm proposing is we don't want to be a melting pot. We're not a melting pot. We are not all the same. And the goal isn't for us to be the same. It's not assimilation. The goal is for us to have diversity. Right, and we're learning that biodiversity is essential for an ecosystem to survive. So it's not we all need to be the same, it's we're not the same, and isn't that great for us to be authentically, like for me to be a Christian and not hedge my bets, right, in talking to Buddhists, and for you to like appreciate that, and I appreciate your Buddhistness. And so we don't have to say, well, all religions are the same, because they're not. And it's much more interesting if all religions aren't the same. We have similarities, right? Because we come from a shared longing. Right? We're all trying to sate the same hunger. But there are fascinating differences in religions. So it's this way of living the paradox that we are all one and we're all different. That's one spiritual attitude to be thinking about, is that we are all one and we are all beautifully different and diverse. I'm going to talk to you about fear. Any comments, thoughts, anything so far? Am I doing okay, Brandy? All right, okay.
This is awesome. Yes. Yeah. I love the melting pot thing, and I've heard someone else say that we're not a melting pot, we're a salad.
Mm-hmm.
We come together beautifully, but
right,
we control our own structure.
Right. Something between a salad and a stew, I think.
Right?
Because there's something
the dressing,
that does... that. Right, the dressing maybe is that. Yeah. Well, they're like overlap this much, but for me, I mean, brokenhearted is when someone I love dies, right? That's brokenhearted. Broken is when I can't get out of bed because I'm so, like, there's brokenness that doesn't have to do with brokenheartedness, and it could have to do with being destitute. and on the street and not knowing where your next meal is going to come from and living in despair because of that. And it's not because of brokenheartedness. It's because of other life circumstances are beating you down. And that we, and in my world, as a priest in an Episcopal church, you know, I deal with both. Like, this is the brokenheartedness of someone I love has died, but also I don't know how I'm going to make it through this day for other reasons of despair. Another question in the back? No? Okay. So we're going to talk next time, and I'm feeling really rushed, like I'm just dumping all kinds of stuff on you because I have a board meeting to get to. But we're going to talk next week. We'll really spend some time talking about fear. That'll be the main topic. But let me touch on it a little bit tonight. And I have a handout. So everything I say is going to be in this handout. So I'm not going to hand it out to you yet. You guys are being so good at not looking at your handouts. Buddhists are much better. Much better than Christians. So tonight, let me just talk about different kinds of fear. There is rational fear. So one kind of fear, because it's not all fear is the same and not all fear is bad. Right? We were created to have fear for a reason. And the good kind of fear is fear that based on something in the real world. Like you're doing something that has a high probability of death or danger. You should be afraid. Okay, I'm going to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. I should be afraid. Now, my fear could either lead me to not do that, to change my mind, or to learn a lot so I do it well. Okay, so fear plays a positive role. That's, you know, if there's a high likelihood of something bad happening, that is perfectly good. There's another kind of fear that's not rational, but is also beneficial. And that's my first job as a priest. I was working at an Episcopal elementary school, pre-K through sixth grade. And one of the things, in one class where we were working with the children so that they could be less likely to be victims of sexual assault, what we were teaching them was to pay attention to their gut. Like if you're in the arcade, an adult comes up to you and says, I need help with something, would you come over here? And your gut is saying, don't do that, to pay attention to that, right? Pay attention to your gut when your gut is saying, there's something wrong here. That's healthy, helpful fear. And then the third kind of fear, in my way of understanding it, is the kind of fear that we experience 98% of the time. All statistics, like, no, I'm sorry, 72% of statistics are made up, by the way. So, but the kind of fear that we mostly experience that gets in the way, right, it's not a helpful thing, unfortunately feels just like that second kind of fear, which is our gut saying there's something wrong in this situation. So it takes discernment to think about, is this the healthy kind of fear, which it likely isn't, or am I just afraid because I'm afraid? And it's that third kind of fear that I want to talk about. And so let's think about what that is. You hear of a terrorist attack in a mall, and you're afraid to go to the mall. Or you see a mole on your back that you hadn't noticed before, and it's ugly, uglily shaped. And you experience fear. Now, what that fear is, is a fiction. So the fear is, I'm going to go to the mall and I'm going to die. Right? Or, I have cancer, I'm going to die. That fear is a fiction. It's not real, right? You're projecting a fiction. It's based in some kernel of reality. I have a mole, right? Or someone in Wichita was, you know, killed in a mall. It's based on this kernel of truth, and then we project this fiction into our future, and then we live our lives as if that fiction were true. And we allow that then to shut ourselves down, to shut our hearts down, to shut our compassion for other people down, to rule our actions. But it's helpful to realize that that is, it's a fiction. It's not real. Now what I want to do is give you some spiritual tools, some tools when that happens, like when that voice happens, right? Or you see the mole or whatever. How do you make it through your life without letting those kinds of fears that are always there get in the way? Okay. So the spiritual goal in this. The spiritual goal, the goal is for us to live our lives without being ruled by these voices of fear. So part of what I want to do is talk with you about how to tame those voices. The other thing I want to talk to you about is how to have resiliency. Because the bad thing will happen. It's just not the bad thing you're afraid of. Right? So you can tame the voices, but still, someone you love is going to die, if you're lucky. Right? If you're lucky, someone you love is going to die, and it will break your heart. So how do you build up resiliency so that you can go through this life, this scary world that's full of danger, and not lose your soul as you're doing it? And so I'm certain this is a Buddhist story. There's a monk standing on the side of the road. The emperor's going by. The monk doesn't bow. The captain of the guard is enraged, hops off his horse, goes up to the monk and says, "Bow." And the monk says, "No, I'm not going to bow." And the captain of the guard draws his sword and points it at the monk and says, "Don't you know I have the ability to run you through without blinking an eye?" And the monk says, "Don't you know I have the ability to be run through without blinking an eye?" So part of the way you get rid of fear is you develop your own sense of stability and groundedness and wholeness so that you can be run through without blinking an eye. Like you can walk through the waves and chaos of the world without being undone or having your center rocked. And for me, it's what Jesus modeled when he was going to the cross, and he was able to live in forgiveness, right? "Father, forgive them, they know not what they're doing," as he's being crucified. He doesn't let the cruelty of other people rob him of his ability to love. He can stay grounded in that and be that person that can be run through without blinking an eye because his love was so pure and so strong. So part of what I want to talk about is how do you develop that? How do you cultivate that? So how do you turn down those voices of fear that are a fiction? And then how do you build up resiliency so that you're not undone when the bad thing does happen? So those are some of the things that I'm going to talk. And I think I'll probably stop there so we can just chat for a little while before I have to dash out. And then next week, I'll be able to relax and not have to feel so rushed. So, thoughts?
Sometimes it's really hard to see the difference between the real fearful thoughts and the ones that are not real, because you're thinking about it, you're feeling, but they're not real.
Right.
So it's really, really hard sometimes to make the difference so you can come out with a positive thinking or something.
Well, and part of it, and we'll talk more about this next week, but part of it is analyzing the situation. Because the likelihood of you being the victim of a terrorist attack is 0.00001%. Right? So part of it is when that fear comes up is analyzing the situation and saying, what really is the likelihood? And for many things, the likelihood is really small that you're going to be impacted by it. So that's, but we'll talk more about that next week. But part of it is just stepping back. And part of it, too, has to do with, it's the same with when your inner critic kicks in and starts beating yourself up. It's realizing that you're not your thoughts. And that there's a way that you can step away from that and going, huh, isn't that interesting what that critic is saying? You can say, isn't that interesting what that fear part of me is afraid of? So that's another strategy, is to realize that you're not your thoughts and look at that as if it was someone else. Like, it's not, you're not that. But we'll talk more about that next week. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I think fear, it's not I'm afraid or I'm not. There's degrees of fear, right? So sometimes it is okay to be afraid and take precautions. If that fear is that good kind of fear that causes me to take precautions, but I don't need to be paralyzed.
Right.
I don't need to be petrified. Right? And so there's degrees of fear. It's not a yes, I'm afraid, or no, I'm not.
The reason I'm smiling is because people have different responses to the presidential election that we just had. My response wasn't positive.
Positive.
Was not positive. So, and I'm in the middle of teaching. I was teaching some of this stuff to my congregation. I'm in the middle of teaching about how to live without fear, and then I'm just terrified. And I was like, oh, we... We were talking with my clergy. We were talking through some things today, and one of the things we said was, "What your soul is like when you're driving, like how you respond to people cutting you off in traffic, is like the bellwether of your state of enlightenment." So the reason I bring that up is because when the election happened, and like I'm going like this on the freakout meter. It was like clear I've not reached enlightenment, right? I can talk a good game, but I'm somewhere not near it. That fear, you know, I understand it, I can teach about it, but when something happens, it just freaks me out. So it is hard to live in it anyway. Yes?
So I feel a strong pull to want to do something, you know, to help lessen the pain of things that are happening, you know, around. But I think I have a lot of fear around doing that.
What would you be afraid of?
I'm not really sure. Physical harm, I think, for myself. Mm-hmm. And being around a lot of anger and hatred, which things like this, to me, it seems like, not that the issues are wrong, but that comes along with it. And maybe fear of coming out more for me.
Thank you. And what I think might be fruitful, if you're interested, is the third time we meet, we can spend some time brainstorming about how we can get involved in our community in this way. Because I think there are a lot of people, and I'm in a in a religious context where we do a lot. Like I know how to do some of this, and I'm connected with, and particularly I'm connected with African American pastors, you know, who live in places where it's a lot rougher and harder, and that many other people are protected from in Sacramento, that we can, you know, so that there are connections that we can make to help. And I would love, and I'm feeling, that's part of what I'm feeling. I walked out of my yoga studio a few weeks ago, and this was prior to the election, and the young woman behind the counter said to me, you know, Brian, and she's in her 20s, and she goes, you know, I have all these millennial friends, and we all want to do something, but we have no idea how. So we need you, Brian, to tell us how to do this, right? So I'm feeling like in the yoga and the Buddhist community or whatever, that aren't, like, I'm feeling this wellspring of people wanting to get involved that can be mobilized. And one of the things we've been doing in our congregation is really learning more about race and racism and white privilege and how all of that functions. And I'm meeting with some people to put together a curriculum that we can roll out to other groups. Because I was thinking about that in terms of my, you know, almost all white yoga studio. Like, what are the conversations? And it's not like it's a hard conversation to have. It's not a combative conversation. It's just it's a group of people that want to learn more. They just don't know where to go to learn. Right. So one of the things I'm working on is packaging some kind of ways to do teachings around race and racism. Another thing is, right now, our city council is looking at changing the use of force policy in the police, looking at giving or not giving our police commission authority to do investigations. And there are communities of color that are crying out for allies in the fight for police accountability. You know, so there are like practical things we can do in our city that people don't know about that can help help us participate in a broader conversation around race that's happening. So there's lots of stuff that we can do that don't put you in harm's way. So I would be happy for us to explore some of that.
Brian, is there a resource put together already that makes all that information available? Or
all what information?
The things that we can do now without getting involved in harm's way.
There's stuff about, I'll send to whomever that can send to everyone here, Brandy. There's stuff, information about the city council meeting. Never mind, it's happening now. It's tonight.
It's tonight,
right. I couldn't go because of my board meeting. It'll be decided tonight. I will send you more information when I get more information on how to be involved. And there are things around Standing Rock that I think are important to be involved in, and the Episcopal Church is certainly very involved in what's happening at Standing Rock. But there's a way in which it's too easy to be involved in something that's far over there.
Is that the Dakota Pipeline?
Yeah. I don't want us to not be involved, but I also don't want us to think that all the problems are there and not in Sacramento. So I'll help with resources around that. I'm going to need to go. Yes, in the back.
Probably not the best thing for you to be on, but going back to the fear thing, I'm unfortunately one of the people who has a lot of legitimized fear in my life. I have a chronic disease, I'm disabled, and there's a lot of things going on. And sometimes I feel like I have so much fear that I'm numb to it, and I don't know when I should fear something else. Mm. Like, I don't recognize appropriate fear because I'm just so used to fear.
Right. you're just confronted constantly with dangers.
So that's, I don't know if that gives a different perspective.
I am a superhero.
And
she is.
I have a hand, the handout I passed out was a handout on sort of the general scope of the whole conversation. I have a separate handout that I'll give you tomorrow or next week that has to do specifically with fear. But if you didn't miss tonight's handout, I'll have a few extra copies here if you didn't get that, okay? Thank you very much. I really appreciate your attentiveness and your willingness to be here, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you.